You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good morning. Thank you very much for joining us today. First of all, I would like to express my very deep appreciation to our co-hosts today, the integration and trade sector of the Inter-American Development Bank, and very especially to my very good friend and colleague, Antoni Esteban Ordal. I don't think this event would have been possible without his support. I also want to express my appreciation to the panelists who really made an effort to be here in a very busy week. I wanted to read to you one paragraph from a very recent article on The Economist that says, when Apple launched the iPhone in 2007, it deployed a state-of-the-art global supply chain. Although the pioneering smartphone was designed in America and sold first to consumers there, it arrived in stores from Shenzhen, China. It had been assembled there by Foxconn International from parts made by two firms in Singapore, six in Taiwan, and two in America. Since then, competition in smartphones has intensified thanks to lower cost rivals such as China's Xiaomi. Now, before we get too enthusiastic about it, we need to do away with any simplistic analysis of where economic clout lies, and a study last year by the Asian Development Bank found that out of $2 billion of iPhone exports from China, only 73 million of their value was actually added in China. So today we are going to be discussing a process that has been three decades in the making, that brought about a dramatic change in how firms organize their production processes. They have become increasingly fractionalized into various stages and geographically dispersed plants across the globe in what are known as global value chains. And therefore, this shift toward global value chains, or synchronized factories, as a book edited by Juan Blythe very nicely calls, has raised very key and very important questions that we hope to discuss today with the very knowledgeable panel that we have. For example, how do global value chains affect global trade governance exercised by the WTO? How do global value chains impact the way in which countries formulate their trade integration agendas? How do global value chains affect the way we actually measure trade and trade flows? And how do global value chains impact the way we see development and macro policy, among other possible subjects? So we have a spectacular panel. I mean, the whole world is represented here, and a host of institutions, the WTO, the OECD, the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the panel will be moderated by our own Joshua Meltzel, a fellow at the Global Economy and Development Program. So, Josh, with no further ado, I'll give you the panel. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Ernesto. I'm just going to be brief so we can get into the panel. We have got a lot to talk about today. So I'm just actually what I'll do is I'll introduce the panelists. Panelists are then going to speak for approximately 8 to 10 minutes. We will have then a moderated discussion up here for a bit, and then we'll open it up to Q&A from the audience. I'm going to start with this end of the panel and work my way down. The first panelist is Xiangjun Wei, who's a chief economist and director general of economic research and regional cooperation department of the Asian Development Bank. He's the chief spokesman at the ADB on economic and development trends and leads their economic and research department, which publishes, amongst other things, their flagship knowledge products. Before joining the ADB, Mr. Wei was the N.T. Wang Chair and Director of the Chazen Institute of International Business at Columbia University and Director of the NBER's Working Group on the Chinese Economy. Prior to Columbia University, he was an Assistant Director and Chief of Division at the IMF, and in 2004 was IMF Chief of Mission to Myanmar, and before that he was Assistant and Associate Professor at Harvard. Bob Koopman's the Chief Economist and Director. We've actually switched sides here, but I'm going to start with... Rayed Safadi, I had this mixed up, is the Deputy Director of Trade and Agriculture at the OECD, where his work includes supporting the G20 and B20 trade agendas on global value chains. Prior to this, he was the Chief Economist for the Government of Dubai, where he was responsible for redefining the economic pillar in Dubai's Strategic Plan 2015 and took a key role in helping the Emirates navigate the 2009 global economic crisis. Bob Koopman, Chief Economist and Director of Economic Research and the Statistics Division at the WTO. At the WTO, Bob provides the Secretariat and member countries with analysis and information on trade and trade policy's role in economic growth and development. Prior to the WTO, Bob was the Director of Operations and Chief Operating Officer at the United States International Trade Commission, where he oversaw the Commission's trade policy research and negotiation assistance on a range of issues, such as anti-dumping, countervailing duties, and intellectual property investigations. He also served as Chief Economist and Director of the Commission's Office of Economics, and prior to that was at the USDA. And to my immediate left is Juan Blyde, who's currently Lead Economist at the Trade and Integration Sector of the Inter-American Development Bank. At the bank, Juan's area of research is on trade and firm productivity, transport costs and international value chains. And prior to the ADB, Juan worked as an economist at the Congressional Economic and Financial Advisory Office of Venezuela. I'd like to start. We're going to actually start the panel in this order and work our way down. So I'd like to ask Juan to start his presentation. Thanks.
Thanks, Joshua. I would like to start by expressing apologies from Antonio Esteban Ordal, who was supposed to come here. He really wanted to be here, but he had to attend to some unexpected urgent matters. So I'm going to base my initial talk on the prospects of Latin American countries to participate in international global value chains. And I think that I will start by mentioning why we think it is important for Latin American countries to participate in global value chain. Why do we think this topic of global value chains is important for the region? And if we think about it in terms of development, I will say that there are at least two reasons why this topic is particularly important. The first reason is related to the potential to diversify production. As Ernesto was mentioning, many goods that in the past were produced in just one country from start to finish, and usually in developed countries, those goods nowadays are produced in, you know, the production of those goods is spread in plants around the globe, including many plants in developing countries. So this increasing international fragmentation of production is opening opportunities for production and trade to many developing countries that they didn't have before. So this is obviously an opportunity to diversify production. And this issue is particularly important for Latin American countries. As many of you probably know, Latin American countries' export base is particularly small. So this is an opportunity to expand that. The second reason why we think this topic is important for the region has to do with the potential gains in productivity. It has been shown in the literature that participation in global value chains can be associated with transfers of technology from these global buyers, these firms that are fragmenting production internationally, to their suppliers in other countries. And that can ultimately translate into gains in efficiency and ultimately gains in productivity. And again, this is an issue that is important for Latin America because, as we all know, Latin American countries tend to grow less than other regions in the world, and the main reason why they grow less is because of the slower productivity growth. So anything that helps us understand better how to improve productivity is welcome in Latin America. So these are at least, in terms of development, why we think this topic is particularly important to better understand how Latin America can address this topic. So in the bank, when we start analyzing this topic, the first thing we wanted to do really was to see really how much Latin American countries participate in global value chains. There were a lot of studies, but there were many case studies, but not really a lot of systematic evidence of how much Latin American countries participate. So we produced a set of battery of many different indicators or proxies of participation in global value chains. And, long story short, is that most of these proxies will tell us a similar story, will support this general perception that Latin American countries do not participate much in these international supply chains relative to regions like Asia or the OECD. So once you are confronted with this evidence, then the question is why? What factors are limiting firms in Latin America to participate more in these international supply chains? And when you think about factors, you can probably group factors in terms of two different factors. Factors that are related to the domestic agenda of each country. That means countries can work on those factors without having to wait for cooperation with other countries. They can just do it on their own. And there are obviously other factors that are related to the international agenda. So because of the time, let me just mention a couple of examples. In terms of the domestic agenda, we think that one factor that is very important is the role of logistics and transportation infrastructure. The general argument here is that these global buyers, these firms that are fragmenting production internationally, then they tend to prefer and use suppliers that are in locations with good logistics infrastructure because that will minimize any delay or any disruption in the arrival of the inputs that they're going to be using in their own production process. Now, we know that the quality of the logistics and transportation infrastructure in Latin America is on average lower than in other regions. So we wanted to know how much that impacts participation in global value chains. So we have some evidence that we can discuss later if you want, that true, if Latin American countries improve, for instance, the quality of the port infrastructure, the airport infrastructure, or the telecommunications infrastructure, that could lead to an increase in, for example, foreign direct investment associated to global value chains of around 20%, which we think is a significant number. So that's one factor that is particularly important in terms of the domestic agenda. Let me move to the international agenda. And in the international agenda, I think that one issue that is always obviously relevant is the issue of regional integration. I think that we all know that the multilateral system will be the one who will achieve the largest efficiency gains in terms of any liberalization, but we cannot deny that countries are pursuing regional integration agreements. Now, here, there is evidence that countries that share trade agreements will share more international production linkages than countries that do not share trade agreements. And the evidence seems to indicate that the impact is larger if those agreements go beyond the simple liberalization of the tariff, of simple lowering of the tariff, and it will go and incorporates also other disciplines that seems to be important for GVCs, like, for example, investment rules, liberalization of trade services, the harmonization of custom procedures, etc. So this seems to be important. Now, we know that Latin America doesn't have a mega regional deep integration agreement. It doesn't even have a mega regional shallow integration agreement. Latin America, the integration in Latin America has proceeded in small blocks. You have Mercosur, you have CAN, you have CARICOM, you have Central America and Mexico, etc. That creates another challenge for the region, a challenge to develop regional value chains in Latin America. And the challenge is that you have several different agreements that have rules that are not necessarily compatible with each other. That makes cementations in the way that, you know, the value chains can be created in the region. So that's the famous problem of the spaghetti wall. So if the region wants to move forward into trying to develop value chains at least at a continental scale, they will have to address this issue of the spaghetti wall, the issue of the convergence. We're talking here about the convergence of trade agreements. So these are a couple of examples in the agenda. What I think that is clear is that there is no one unique factor that limits participation firms in Latin America to participate in global value chains. There are many different factors, and I just mentioned a couple of them. So that means that there is not a magic bullet in terms of policies. There is not like the GVC policy. If governments in the region wants to participate more, wants their firms to participate more in this international supply chains, they will have to see this in as a set of complementary policies in order to move forward. I think I will leave it like that for now.
Thanks, Joshua and Ernesto. I appreciate the opportunity to come and try to contribute positively to this panel. Being at the WTO and dealing with global value chains, particularly when you see that there are very strong regional value chains, at the same time extensive discussions going on regional integration agreements. There's often a question, GVCs and the WTO, and the question I think the Brookings folks put together is how do GVCs affect global governance exercised by the WTO? And I think I would argue that the WTO helps create a set of common rules, improve certainty around factors important to GVC development, as well as lowering tariffs and other trade costs. And low tariffs and trade costs are often very important in this global fragmentation, understanding that. So I think GVCs in general provide a pretty strong rationale for many of the things that the World Trade Organization is supposed to provide on a multilateral basis. So these multilateral rules and commitments turn out to be pretty darn important. Now, GVCs require clear, transparent rules. They also like certainty. So to go into a little bit more about how WTO agreements can help with that, bound tariffs help provide certainty. Okay, so that's a pretty clear and obvious area. Dispute resolution mechanisms, commitments in the services and investment and intellectual property areas all help articulate a set of principles or rules that provide some global governance to operations in global value chains. Most recently, the Trade Facilitation Agreement, which is very much focused on trying to reduce trade costs, helps significantly, and it's focused very precisely on lowering non-tariff border-related costs, all of which we know are very important from a large number of research efforts on important attributes and contributors to the development of global value chains. So we have this nice multilateral foundation, but we also have a number of regional preferential trade agreements under negotiation that tend to go beyond that. And that, I think, is because many of the firms that participate in global value chains want even more certainty, more clarity than the multilateral agreements provide at this point. But many elements in some of these deeper regional integration agreements are potentially multilateralizable. Okay, so commitments on standards and some regulatory coherence investment are, tend to be things that you can't apply on a discriminatory basis. So we tend to see some of those things as helping at the multilateral level, even if they're not negotiated at the World Trade Organization. Now, another very important aspect is the role that the WTO has in transparency and monitoring. So countries have a responsibility to report changes in trade policy under certain aspects of the WTO agreements. And we regularly provide the trade, the TPRM trade policy review mechanism where countries come in and we do an in-depth assessment of the trade policy environment for those countries, all of which allows other countries to ask questions about the operating environment, the commercial environment that they have questions about in terms of the country under review, and it allows the country under review to make a case as to what it says or what it thinks it's doing with its trade policies. This kind of transparency and monitoring, as I indicated, I think is very important to global value chains because if you're going to integrate into the global economy, if you're going to get FDI, if you're going to get these investments, and if you're going to join those supply chains, this notion of transparency and certainty are extraordinarily important. Now, I want to talk about one last aspect here. And that's GVCs and economic growth. There's been, and Raed and I have had a number of discussions about this with some of our colleagues at the World Bank and IMF. And there's a big debate right now that the relationship between trade growth and GDP growth has slowed down. For a number of years, we saw what some people refer to as the trade elasticity, the rate of growth of trade to GDP was well above 2. Trade tended to grow about twice as fast as GDP, and it slowed down recently. And a lot of the questions surround whether or not this is cyclical, related to sort of broader macroeconomic factors, or is it structural? Is it and a big part of that focus is it the fact that maybe GVCs are starting to slow down or peter out? Or and we tend to be a little bit sanguine about that. We're less concerned about how much trade grows as we are about making sure that trade continues to positively contribute to growth and that what trade does occur occurs as frictionlessly and as natural as possible. So China moving up the value chain and importing less imported parts and components because they've developed the capabilities to produce them domestically is just a fine thing, okay? But it does affect the global value chain. Traditional trade data doesn't necessarily allow you to track this as well as GVC data does. So the OECD WTO TIVA database can provide very significant and deep insights as to the operation, the transparency, and the monitoring of global trade and how it affects economic growth. This is an area that I think needs more attention. There's right now a very significant concern about a new mediocre, and there's interest in trying to figure out how trade can positively contribute to that. And if you look at trade from gross trade flows, you don't necessarily know, just based on gross trade flows, how much of that is actually value added generated in an economy. The TIVA database allows you to do that, and it allows you to look at the distribution of trade's growth to various economies. I do have one last point, and this will be my last point. Global value chains are actually an extension of something called domestic value chains, right? Juan, you were talking about sort of the domestic aspects of global value chains. And often I'm at the World Trade Organization, I care a lot about trade, but I think it's pretty important to realize that coming across the border with foreign direct investment and helping to contribute to a country's economic growth from across the border is one way to do it. But recognizing that creating an ecosystem where you develop a strong domestic value chain that's consistent with international rules so that you can dock very well with a global value chain is likely to generate more economic growth than what you get out of a global value chain. Now, this is not a new insight, but referring to structural reform and domestic policy reform from the concept of a domestic value chain brings about a consistency in how we look at international and domestic behavior. My old organization, the USITC, has looked at this kind of question from the U.S. perspective and found some very interesting insights there about how small and medium-sized enterprises in the United States actually export more indirectly by being part of a domestic value chain for multinationals and large firms. The small and medium-sized enterprises don't necessarily know that they're producing output that's dependent on the global marketplace, but they are dependent indirectly through the larger firms' trade. So understanding this notion of domestic and global value chains and their complementarity and having a general set of principles that apply, allowing domestic their own domestic authority, right? Each country wants to have its own ability to set its rules and regulations, but making sure that those rules and regulations are at least in some way consistent with global rules then allows you to integrate and tap into external demand more efficiently and effectively. And I'll close there. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Bob already alluded to the OECD WTO TIVA, Trade in Value Added Database. For us, it was very clear to understand this increasing fragmentation of world production across sites across the world. We needed first to measure it before we analyze and then come up with the policy implications. So that was a major effort by two organizations, the OECD and the WTO, to put together this database. And we started actually looking behind those figures. Ernesto just mentioned, for example, you know, the Apple products and China, and the how much domestic value added of these Chinese exports to the United States of just Apple products, and it's a very, very small value added at the domestic level in China. So, what are the implications of such trends or such fragmentation? The first one is, for those of you who paid attention to the China example, is the imbalance story. And it's an important story to tell. So if you look at the gross value added between the bilateral trade between the U.S. and China, for example, you will find a large deficit of the United States vis-à-vis China. If you look at the value-added components and not the gross statistics, those gross value or the deficit goes down by 30% if you take our measure, and if you take Chinese measure, it goes down by 55%. That's important, at least from a policy perspective, in terms of, you know, trying to find the right response to the right set of measures. A second trade policy implication, actually, a straightforward policy implication. Juan alluded to this regional aspect. Now, think about it. No matter how deep those regional integration arrangements go into, in terms of standards at the border, behind the border, mutual recognition, or what have you, they risk to leave some important countries who are important in terms of the value chain of some sectors outside this regional integration. So even that regional integration agreements in terms of, you know, their concepts and how you go about doing them, it is important to take another look lest you leave some important countries outside those RTAs and end up in a trade diversion type of a thing. Think about also the trade disputes. What do they mean, the anti-dumping, in a world dominated by value chains rather than, you know, gross? There was a very famous case in 2008 and 2009 of EU imports of shoes from a certain country. So that ended up with anti-dumping duties against the origin or the supposed origin of those shoes. It turned out that 70% of the value added of those shoes originated in the EU. So you impose anti-dumping duty on yourself at the end of 70% of it at least, right? That's an important aspect, right? So you need actually to first, as I said, measure it, then, you know, make sure that whatever policy follows actually responds to the underlying problem. Managing economic shocks. I mean, look what happened in 2009. All of a sudden, and Bob alluded to this trade growth business, what happened is that in certain regions, trade collapsed by 30% in the first quarter 2009, right? With ripple effects across the globe because of this global value chain business, right? And that is an important aspect to keep in mind. Now, what happened afterwards is that recovery was, if you look at how countries recovered following the crisis, we found out that those who were open, more open to trade, were the one who recovered fastest from this collapse. So these are, you know, critical policy implications that you need to think of. Now, what does it mean also at the domestic level? Think about it. Today, what does an export promotion policy mean in reality? In reality, it's an import promotion too. For you to export, you need to import. And that is a clear and important policy implication. Between 30 and 60% of G20 countries' exports are intermediate imports. 48% of manufacturing exports are services exports, services embedded in manufacturing at the global level. These are statistics from the TIVA database. What does it mean? What does it mean, you know, in terms of your competitiveness of any one country? The service sector reform and efficiency is critical to not only services exports and services trade, but also for manufacturing. That is a clear message. Now imagine even your garden variety tariffs and non-tariff barriers at the border. What do they mean? When an Apple or an iPhone product actually, you know, cross China at least 8 times between China, Japan, you know, where they add in Japan the rare earth business and then back to China, then off to another country. At least seven different times a typical Apple product crosses the Chinese border. Imagine that every time you pay tariffs on this, right? So even small, low tariffs, when you add them up cumulatively, they can rise to a prohibitive level of tariff. So that tells you a lot about, you know, the importance of tariffs. You know, just your standard, you know, when we thought about, if you looked at the research before this global value chain business, I mean, all will start by saying now average tariffs are low, they're 4 to 5%, but when they accumulate them, you can get into 35 to 45%. So back in the era of you know the 60s. So another thing, and Juan alluded to, is the trade facilitation, what he called, you know, logistic, which is part of a trade facilitation business. So trade facilitation means what? I mean, every day an import or an export gets delayed at the border means it eats up into your competitiveness. And therefore, you need actually to streamline those procedures, and you need to take a really good look at what happens so that you become part of this regional or global value chain. And let's not forget the services story. The services story is where all the action is. So in industrial policy of today is actually a services industrial policy, right? So competitiveness, when you think about it, 48% of your manufacturing exports are services, right? So how much of a targeted industry support level or protection level would matter if any one of your services activities, be they logistics, transport, you know, banking, insurance, you name it, right, storage, all these services activities that go into the manufacturing of goods lack efficiencies or trail on the efficiency front. It's a critical aspect of the story. Now, package it all up. That's a trade policy scenario. What is critical in this whole discussion, and what is, has become apparent, and what Ernesto and everyone else on the panel this morning said, you're no longer doing a product, you know, from A to Z. You're putting part. So not, now what we're talking about is not a trade in cars or trade in electronics, but trade in tasks, right? So a task of producing something, right, from imported inputs, which is what we call backward integration, processing a bit, adding value, domestic value, sending it to stage number two or number three, you know, in another country where another value added, domestic value added is put in, and then off it goes. So we were able in this TIVA database to go all the way to seven stages, and we want to go further. Not only do we want to do that, you know, just for, to get the value added and the trade component, we want to know the investment component. Now, what does it mean when we go back to China? Because, you know, Ernesto started with a China example. So if you go back to China and you say, okay, those $73 million worth of exports, the domestic component of those exports of Apple products, who owns them? Foxconn did it, but you know, who owns the technology? Who is the foreign investor there? How much of the value went to profits? How much of this went to wages? Right? We want to know. And who owns these well, intellectual assets or whatever else? And then you know the profits and whether the profit stays within China or the profits is repatriated to the mother, you know, company. And of course, if you look at it globally, 95% of global trade of these regional global value chains is conducted by the multinational enterprises. And this is why, you know, the G20 now is talking about, oh, this is M&E business, right? The transparency issue, the governance issue at the global level. But, you know, one thing that, that has been missing from this action is that these M&Es rest their trade, their production and their trade rests on what? The SME, right, sector, the small, medium enterprises. So the small, medium enterprises, if you look at them, and we're now trying to actually get the numbers before we start telling anecdotes and stories, how much forward linkages, meaning or indirect export, if you will, that they engage in. So mostly you'll see that they're domestic operation of those SMEs, but in fact these SMEs are responsible for a large chunk of the exports of the M&Es because they feed into the M&Es, and we want to know what the what those shares are and how much you know of the internationalization story SMEs have. It is a critical aspect because this is where in some countries in Asia, and we'll get to hear about it, you know, 80 to 85% of employment is actually the M&E sector, right? So if you want to talk about trade, you know, to talk about development, job creation, you know, you want to talk about the policies of the SMEs. Finally, because I'm told that I have 1 minute, think about this global value chain and the policy behind them. It is imperative that you think a whole of supply chain policy package rather than just what I just talked to you told you today. The trade policy aspects. There are development aspects. There are aspects cutting across the investment front, the competition front, the IPR front. You name it. It's a development story. It's not just a trade story. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Since people at the back cannot see me, so I thought I would stand up. But at least you have some visibility. Thank the organizers for including me at this panel. I want to add one line since we are at Brookings to my bio, which is that I was once a senior fellow at Brookings Institution holding an endowed chair called the New Century Chair in International Economy and Trade. That New Century Chair was endowed by a company that's a leading company in global value chain, Toyota Company, from a country that's one of the major participants from regional and global value chains, Japan. And this morning I want to share five thoughts with you. Number one, if you look around the world, there's very uneven degree of participation in regional and global value chains. By regional global value chains, we are talking about, you know, the production of a product or service or a widget that crosses multiple national borders. But different countries have very different degree of participation. So Japan, Korea, China, you know, countries in Northeast Asia tend to be, you know, major participants value chain, cross-border value chains. Many of the Southeast Asian countries are also in that category, including, you know, Singapore, Thailand, and so on. North America, United States, Canada, and to some degree Mexico certainly are very heavily involved in regional and global value chains. Much of the Europe are very integrated in their ways too. But there are other countries that are integrated in much less deep way. You know, countries in many countries in South Asia, many countries in Central Asia, for example, and Africa are much less integrated. So there's very big variations in the degree of deepness or shallowness in participation in global value chains. That's first point. Second point: the degree of participation in global value chains do seems to be very well linked to the extent a country is able to expand its output and job creation, that you see strong positive association between these two. The exact mechanism, exact causality, you know, additional research needs to be pursued. Certainly, we'll see that countries that are deeply integrated in either regional or global value chains also tend to grow a bit faster in terms of GDP, a bit better at creating jobs relative to their peers. In that sense, that probably supports why most governments have the intuition that they want to help their firms to be even deeper integrated into regional or global value chains. Number three, at the same time, you know, it also worth thinking about: could global value chains or regional value chains carry risk? And one particular kind of risk is potential contagion risk, spread of negative shocks, a recession, and financial shock from one country to the other through value chains. Now, a concrete example of this, since I started with Toyota and Japan example, you know, when Fukushima, when the nuclear accident happened in Japan, you know, many of the factories around the accident site were shut down, and people discovered to some surprise that some of the key inputs, ingredients to global car production actually came from that region in Japan, including a particular pigment or a particular paint, apparently, globally, not just Toyota, but Toyota's Japanese rivals and Toyota's American rivals also use that particular ingredient from that particular part of Japan. So for a few months, globally, you cannot buy, there are no new cars of that particular color, actually, for a while. I mean, this is a illustration of the possibility that when you have, precisely when you spread production stages across national borders, you could also increase vulnerability to shocks far away from you. And because the production stages are so spread out, you may not even realize where each of the ingredients ultimately comes from. So that's a potential real danger. My colleagues at Asian Development Bank look into how serious this danger is, and we concluded that as of now, there's no strong evidence that the global value chain exacerbate those kind of contagion risks so much that we need to worry about this. Point number one. Point number two: to the extent there may be vulnerability associated with dependent on foreign supplies, close and near and far, this could also create opportunities. I previously just said that there's uneven participation in global value chains. Many countries in Central Asia and South Asia say they want to be better plugged in regional global value chains. They don't know where to start. Now, the concern about potential vulnerability with existing chains, together with some other concerns like rising labor cost in traditional strong participant in global value chains like China, has motivated or incentivized global firms to look for alternative. You want to, instead of having one chain, you might want to have multiple chains to build a bit more robustness or resilience to this. I used to teach an executive MBA class for Columbia Business School. You see the evolution. So companies we visit and talk to, from talking about every company has to have a China strategy to China Plus One strategy. Now people talk about China Plus N strategy, motivated by multiple considerations, but one of which is you don't want to have just one chain of intermediate supplies tied to one particular regions, potentially making yourself too vulnerable to shocks from one source. So in other words, the flip side of potential vulnerability could also provide opportunities to firms and countries that have so far not been a major participant in global value chains but wish to do so. Point number four, once we think about regional global value chains, it could alter our understanding of many things we might have taken for granted for too long. For example, in this particular city, there has been a long tradition of being obsessed with U.S.-China bilateral trade. You know, U.S. has too big deficit, China has too large trade surplus. One of the insights from the global value chain research pursued by people here and others in the literature is to point out that if you look at trade balance in value-added terms, it turns out Chinese surplus against U.S. is much, much smaller than if you simply look at gross trade. So the intuition behind what I just said is this. Why, Chinese gross export relative to import seems to be this much bigger than, what is the number, Bob, 55. Roughly? 55 billion?
No, in terms of the surplus.
It's a gross bilateral surplus. Bob is deep position. No. Okay, all right. All right. So some of us should really know the number. I should know the number, but let's see 100. What has been pointed out, of course, is much of the Chinese exports to U.S., iPhone is a very good example of this, in fact, are indirect exports coming from Japan, who supply components of smartphones or auto parts or others, electronics, and Korea and Singapore and other economies in the region. So they are actually, what it show up on the U.S. data is imports from China. In fact, they are imports of value added from many other countries in Asia. In contrast, most of the U.S. exports to China truly represent U.S. value added, because U.S. Exports have much higher domestic value added content. Once you do the adjustment, you discover that the true bilateral trade trade in value-added term is much smaller than in gross trade terms. And one and two, you also discover behind officially that there's a network of production chain, regional or global, behind it. So that's one example of things that we might have taken, people on the hill may have taken for granted, but potentially would ask for a rethinking once you think from a global and regional value chain point of view. The second example is about notion of comparative advantage. Let me start with examples. I've been to many forums sponsored by investment banks. People often were surprised by the fact that in the last year and a half, Japanese yen has depreciated so much. Yet Japanese exports didn't increase as much as previous experience would have suggested. People thought, traditionally the way Japanese economy recovers by promoting exports. And one way to promote exports in Japan's own history was to engineer large yen depreciation. Now that part is done. Yen has depreciated a lot. Japanese export, on the other hand, didn't rebound very much. That was considered a puzzle. But one partial solution to that puzzle, in fact, is the regional global value chain idea. Nowadays, much of the Japanese exports of value added have to be done indirectly by being bundled, for example, with Chinese value added through factories located in China. What's noteworthy in that context is in the last year, Chinese currency has been appreciating very strongly. Chinese currency is one of the very few currencies that have been appreciated against U.S. dollar and therefore against most other countries China trades with. And interestingly, in the context we're just talking about, that this Chinese currency appreciation partially offset the effect of yen depreciation on Japan's ability to export its value added. Point number five, the last point, is about, suppose countries decided they want to be better plugged into global or regional value chains, what can they do, right? So the extensive research done by people at this table and others have provided quite a few insight. Number one, it is important to keep tariff low and predictable. And one of the reasons is the reason that Mr. Safadi mentioned, that nowadays when you spread the production across multiple stages to, you know, to export iPhone, so many intermediate goods have to cross borders so many times, a given level of tariff will end up having multiply itself before it shows up in the cost of the final good. In that sense, you know, if you want to attract factories to be willing to produce intermediate goods in your country, you really need to keep your tariff low and predictable. Number two, more broadly, companies care not just about how much tariff it has to pay, but broadly how much cost it is to move things in and out. This also means, you know, non-tariff barriers, something WTO works on, is important, but also means, you know, broadly defined logistics cost, like quality of the port, ability for a port to move around things quickly and cheaply, ability for, you know, for roads and railway system to be able to transport goods, intermediate goods and final goods between factories and a port and other cities, do this cheaply and quickly, will be a key determinant of how or whether a country can be a successful participant in global value chains. Put it crudely, one of the reasons why China has managed to change itself from one of the most closed economies in 1980 to be one of the leading participants in global value chains has a lot to do with its infrastructure projects. You know, nowadays, everyone now is familiar with the fact, you know, I used to travel between New York and D.C. Often, that the four-hour train, if it were in China, would have been 40 minutes train. That's an extreme example of, you know, now the difference in the quality of infrastructure. But China has, all of these things were new thing, but the quality of the infrastructure actually translates into much lower cost of moving people and goods and intermediaries around, enhancing the competitiveness of all the firms in the country and enhancing the ability of such a country to be a leader in global value chains. And number three, you know, we need to ensure other stuff that sounds good, product standards and so on, will not become hidden barriers to trade. Finally, let me conclude the things that, you know, these are things the country can do, but multinational organizations can also help. Asian Development Bank is a think and do tank. So our research arm, of course, think about issues we're talking about, but our other parts of the bank directly involved in helping countries to build better infrastructure, better roads, ports, more reliable energy supplies, so that firms in those countries can be more competitive participants in global value chains. We also help with trade facilitation, cross-border trade facilitations. They all move in that direction. Thank you very much. Let me share these initial thoughts first. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I think we had some excellent presentations there, and there's a lot to talk about. I want to pick up on a couple of points that a couple of the panelists made, which is this issue about the indirect participation in global value chains, and particularly how SMEs are participating through their supplies to MNCs and their engagement then in the global economy. And what I want to do is talk a little bit about, firstly, the opportunities that there might be for SMEs to participate directly in global value chains, not necessarily through their domestic suppliers to MNCs. In this context, talk a little bit about the role of the internet here and the opportunities this might be providing SMEs to participate in global value chains. And when you answer this question, talk also a little bit more about services. Riyadh talked about the servicification of the manufacturing sector and the role of services more broadly in global value chains and the way that the internet can enable this. Whoever wants to start.
Well, sorry, I missed. What were you saying?
Here, I'll go ahead.
Okay, sir.
So, you know, the internet provides great opportunities for SMEs to participate, but trade costs are often a challenge for them. So the internet can get them noticed and access to the global marketplace, but you still have to worry about they have to worry about paying customs expenses. They have to know about rules and regulations for various exports. There's been some very good work done based on, I think, data from eBay and PayPal and maybe one other on very, very micro detailed transactions data that seems to suggest that things like the Internet provide a great opportunity for SMEs. I often, in an Internet search looking for a particular product, will end up at sort of aggregator sites in China where suppliers for products are looking to connect with perhaps purchasers, although those tend to be intermediate kinds of goods. So, it is a great opportunity. I don't think it's a magic bullet. Right? I don't think it's pixie dust. I don't think it fixes things, but it does help SMEs to access global demand. But there are still significant trade costs. Maybe it helps with final demand for final goods than it does necessarily help with intermediates and components. But maybe Shengjin knows more. Let me do ask, since Shengjin put me on the spot.
Yes.
And I used Google and went to an OECD publication. And in 2009, the gross deficit, U.S. deficit with China was $190 billion. And the TIVA deficit, or the value added deficit, was about $125 billion. So,
sorry, I didn't know that you were actually going for the panel. So, on the SME business, right? If you look at the behind the borders measures, right, the standards, the regulation, all what we call the regulatory interventions, you realize, without even measuring it, and we're trying now to measure their participation, right, the SMEs, that such measures fall disproportionately, their costs fall disproportionately higher on SMEs than on MNEs, right? Hence, their ability to actually deal with all the different standards across countries, be they health standards, technical barriers, technical standards, what have you, right? They have, for them, vis-a-vis, relative to multinational corporations, their higher costs. And that needs to be, looked into. Now, what is the solution? First, let's find out what the regulations are. If you look at the services sector, any profession or any service delivery, you have two issues to think about. First, the market access, meaning, am I, as a service provider, can I first enter this market? I enter the market, and then what are the conditions imposed on me as a foreigner to be able to operate in this market? This is a huge task for an SME. Huge task. And therefore, they today, we say, well, they're not internationalized, but hold on a minute. We have no evidence to support that because, as I said, where are these MNEs manufacturing and or sourcing their inputs, be they goods or services, from the local SMEs? We want to know those linkages and what has been termed within the literature as the indirect exports. Right now, is there anything virtuous about exporting versus sourcing or selling to a domestic firm? I don't know. Are there, higher profit margins to be had? Now, what you think of is the technology transfer, whether they're, playing with a local M&E or a, cross-border M&E. Do they actually acquire higher knowledge, higher technical capacity that they import? And these are the questions that, it's all anecdotal. And certainly for those economists amongst us, the SME business, we don't have a theory about those SMEs. For me now, within the G20 of this year, the biggest question for Turkey is how to help SMEs participate more fully into global value chains. The automatic assumption is that they're not participating, which is, highly disputed, at least I will dispute it. To whom are these guys selling, right? I mean, that's they're selling to these MNCs, and I want to find out. Now, I want to measure this. Access to finance. Everyone has a problem with access to finance. What do we propose from a policy perspective? That we lower the financial requirements, or that we help countries tap into international financial or SMEs tap into international financial markets in a much more straightforward way, as the MNC the multinational corporations can actually tap the euro dollar, whatever financial markets out there in the world. These are the types of questions that we want to ask, especially if the original task comes from a policymaker telling you, I want an initiative within a G20, right, who are meeting this week here in Washington to try and promote better participation of SMEs in GVCs. A lot of the acronyms today, sorry about that, but this is actually... No, and then someone added the LIC, which is the low-income countries.
Thanks.
In GVCs.
On e-commerce and small medium enterprises, let me say three things. Number one, the e-commerce is in principle a great force for good for SMEs. Therefore, indirectly also a great force, potential great force for poverty reduction and inclusive growth in general. Let me give you an example. So, one of the largest Chinese companies listed in the U.S. this year was Alibaba. How many of you have heard about Alibaba? How many of you have never heard
not
about
it? Not the Alibaba, the flying
not the,
thing.
Not the fairy tale, but the e-commerce company. The largest e-commerce company in China. So what does the Alibaba do for SMEs? So there are rural villages in Fujian. Tea growers that previously you have to sell tea growers to a monopoly intermediary firm for a very low price, and they were the middlemen, mostly state-owned firm, but even for local-owned firm, they were large firm. They buy from small size of tea growers and then sell to the cities. Most of the profit will go to the middlemen. Tea farmers will not get very much. Now, and one of the problems for small firms is actually marketing your product. You are a small firm to ultimate consumers, it's extremely expensive on a per kilogram of stuff you sell, right? E-commerce helped to solve that problem. It turned out to be not very costly to set up a virtual shop on Alibaba. And many tea farmers nowadays do this. And you can build up a reputation. So they will say, try my tea, if it doesn't work, send it back to me. Or you don't have to pay me until you like it. People become very entrepreneurial. They can try various things. Nowadays, you see a lot of newly wealthy farmers who became wealthy by making good use of the new opportunities created by e-commerce. So that's a very concrete example. Similarly, we have seen suitcase makers in Shanxi province, rural areas, former rural areas. People decided to try. Someone have a skill in making baskets or suitcases, so on. They discover there's a market, and they can now greatly reduce the cost of marketing, cost of reaching customers by opening up shops on Alibaba. So these are very concrete examples of things that small firms get helped by internet companies. Point number one. Point number two, for them to be fully taking advantage of the new opportunities offered by e-commerce. Having e-commerce is not enough. You need other complementary inputs. For example, in order for the tea farmers in Fujian, suitcase makers, small suitcase makers in Shanxi to sell successfully in Shanghai, Guangzhou, Beijing, or abroad, one of the things is you have to be able to deliver your stuff, small quantity things, relatively inexpensively to your customers. Therefore, I go back to the point of now China has so many roads and so many also highly competitive goods delivery companies that can deliver things at relatively, in my view, ridiculously low rate, but anyway, very, very low rate, also help their complementary inputs, conditions that allow small firms to take advantage of e-commerce to its full extent. access to finance, Mr. Safedi mentioned, is another important input, right? So a typical problem, one of the problems facing by small firms, entrepreneurial firms, you have good ideas. You might have some idea that should work, except you need some investment to pay for the, you know, factory, hire workers, buy materials. You go to a bank, to, you know, typical farmer doesn't really have that much asset to start a business. You go to a bank, you ask for a loan. Typically, that's not unique to China. Most developing countries, bank will say no. Why? Because the only way a classic bank is willing to make a loan is if someone has a collateral. And the only thing that qualifies as a collateral is something that cannot be moved, a deed to a piece of land, expensive house, you know, factory floors, you know, something that a startup entrepreneur, small firm entrepreneurs, often do not have. That's a practical barrier for someone to start a business. Interestingly, you don't have the equivalent of barriers in U.S. and many high-income countries. Financial system have managed to have innovated to solve their problem partially by allowing banks to take some of the movable assets, raw material, is collateralizable assets. To do that, you have many things. You have to be able to register movable assets, be able to track it, having proper anti-fraud system in place and so on and so forth. So Asian Development Bank, in fact, also works with many member countries on this particular dimension to help set up asset registration system to facilitate banks to be able to take movable assets as collateral and be willing and able to make loans to small firms. It's another complementary thing that need to be put in place in order for small firms to take advantage of the e-commerce opportunity. Finally, the last thing is, when we talk about allowing small firms to sell abroad, then you have this cross-border piece. The cross-border trading cost cannot be too high. Cross-border, you have recognition of the standard and so on and so forth. And they will require Bob and his colleagues to further push forward, you know, on the trade negotiation side, so that trade facilitation and other costs of trading, together with World Bank, ADB, and so on, to make sure cross-border cost of trading will be sufficiently low so that the small firms can be better take advantage of the cross-border trading opportunity offered by e-commerce.
I think I will just mention very quickly, answer your question in terms of the Mexican example. As we know, Mexican economy participates a lot in international supply chains, but typically it has been on the maquiladora industry, so which is the assembly section of the supply chain. So they receive a lot of inputs from the United States, and then they perform the assembly. So the dilemma in Mexico is typically how we can add more Mexican value to the supply chains that we already participate. So that would be sourcing more from the domestic economy, which is what you're saying, the exporting indirectly. Now, what we have seen in not necessarily Mexico, but in other countries too, is that the matching between the supplier and a buyer in a global value chain is very hard because the relationship is very specific. I mean, imagine that I'm producing an engine and I want to offshore the piston of that engine. Well, I need to find a supplier that can produce that piston with the precise characteristic that will work on the engine that will work on my engine that I'm producing. From the point of view of the supplier has to know what those characteristics are. The supplier has to know if it's capable to adapt its production process to meet those characteristics, etc. So what I'm trying to say is that the amount of information that you need in order to do the matching between the buyer and supplier in a global value chain is typically much higher than the amount of information that you need in order to do the matching between a supplier and a buyer when you are selling a commodity, for example, that the only information that is relevant is the price. So countries tend to do policies in order to facilitate this exchange of information between buyers and suppliers. For example, there are countries that do clinics, so they bring the buyer and they sit down in front of potential suppliers and explain them what kind of relationship they expect to have with their suppliers, what kind of contracts they expect to have, what kind of certification the supplier should have, what kind of shipping procedures they have to have, etc. Now, can that be done through the internet? Yes, and that's where the internet comes. I think that internet can facilitate this kind of matching between the supplier and the buyer. So the internet can be used to address this issue of the information problem. At the end, this is an issue of information problem. In fact, I just do an advertisement. At the bank, we have, for example, an initiative. It's called Connect Americas, which is precisely a website where you have matching between buyers and suppliers, not necessarily only in global value chains, but it's an example of something that internet can do in order to eliminate or at least reduce this information problem.
Great, thanks. With the remaining time, I think let's open it up to Q&A from the audience. I think we've got a microphone. If you want to ask a question, raise your hand. Please introduce yourself. Please make sure that you end with a question mark. We'd like questions. You can ask them to the panelists specifically or generally. I think we've got one here to start with.
Thank you very much, the panel. Kevin Chang and from the IMF, and actually we've been working on very similar issues, the GVC, and in fact in 2 weeks, on May the 27th, the Asia Department of the IMF will release the Asia Region Economic Outlook. And on Chapter 2, myself and my co-author are working on a piece on GVC and how Asia can utilize GVC and benefit more. And one particular issue that we look into that is how GVC alter the response of exchange rate on the competitiveness. So I want to ask your the panel's opinion on that. Basically, you see in the GVC, as some of the panelists mentioned, it changes like the relationship. For example, if you put like a tariff, you're not tariffing your trading partners, competitors. You're also tariffing on yourself. Similarly, in exchange rate, if you you import also to export. So when you depreciate or when you appreciate, that may have a different impact on the than a traditional theory predict. And that's what we are doing. I want to hear the panelists' experts' opinion first.
I'm just going to collect a couple more questions. One at the front here, and one at the back there.
Hi, I'm Mauricio Ochoa from SAIS. I have a question for Juan Blight. You talked about the Mexican example, and I wanted to know, like, what do you think if Mexico should target, like, an expansion to other markets rather than the United States one, or, like, adding more value added to the American market?
Thanks. I think there's one gentleman somewhere.
Hi, my name is Alin. I'm also a second-year student at SAIS. And in the context of developing countries, especially those which are exporters of natural resources, I wonder how they can engage in global value chains, given that their currency appreciates or the price of tradables goes up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Juan, do you want to start?
I can say something about the tariff issue that Kevin raised. I think that is also related to what Red said about exporting promotion is also important for importing promotion. I'm just going to mention one particular example that we saw in the book. This is a firm from Sweden that produced high-end shoes, and that firm wanted to offshore one part of the shoe to a firm in Argentina. The Argentina firm knew it could produce one subcomponent of that part, but not the entire component, not the entire part. So, and they couldn't find another supplier in Argentina that could produce the other subcomponent, but they found one in Brazil. So, and then they used the one in Brazil to produce the entire part and then ship it to the Swedish firm. If there would have been a tariff between Brazil and Argentina on that particular part, then that part would not have been competitive for the firm to be able to stay with the Swedish buyer. So that's just one concrete example of that. You know, sometimes we want to protect our economies from competition, but we are harming them because these producers are already subfragmenting whatever they need to do, and they're finding their complementarity not in their own country but in other countries. So they're using imports from other countries in order to complement their own capabilities, because normally they don't have a complete set of capabilities. So I just want to mention that. Mauricio, for the Mexican example, I think that you raised the issue of Mexico trying to integrate only. We already know that Mexico is already trying to integrate with other countries in the region. For example, with the Pacific Alliance, etc. And I will put that. I will answer your question in the context of of what I mentioned before, the problem of all these trade agreements, that Mexico has several trade agreements, for example. And let's see what happened. For example, Mexico, I'm going to give you a concrete example. Mexico signed three trade agreements with countries in Central America, one with Nicaragua, one with Honduras, and one with the Triangle of Norte, which is El Salvador, Guatemala, and a third country. But these three agreements didn't talk to each other. So what the meaning practice is that a firm in Costa Rica producing chocolates, they could produce the chocolates and sell it to Mexico without having to pay tariff. But if they use cacao paste from Honduras to produce those chocolates, they will have to pay tariff if they sell it to Mexico. Something that seems odd, because the cacao paste from Honduras, they don't have to pay tariffs in Mexico, but they all, because it has a trade agreement between Honduras and Mexico too. The thing is that these trade agreements didn't talk to each other, so that fragmented the possibilities to do a regional value chain between these countries. These guys understood these problems, and in 2011, they did what is called accumulation of rule of origins. Basically, what it does in practice is that now a firm in Costa Rica can use this cacao paste from Honduras and sell the chocolate to Mexico without having to pay tariff in Mexico. That's what the issue of the convergence of trade agreements should look like. So you will be able to source your inputs, whatever the inputs are, more competitive, not only in your domestic example. And the last question about natural resources. What we saw were cases that were very interesting, because the I'm going to give an example of a firm in Brazil that was producing coffee in the commodity market. I mean, this was like a low quality coffee. This firm is called La Terra. La Terra was producing this low-quality coffee, and, of course, the price of the coffee is just a commodity, so it goes up and down. Now, what happened? These firms managed to enter into the supply chain of Illy Cafe. Illy is the Italian company that produces coffee, high-quality, differentiated coffee. So what happened is that the price of the high-quality, differentiated coffee doesn't change that much as the low-quality. So the firm was able to escape this evolution to the cycle of the commodity price by inserting itself in a value chain. How they do it? Well, it managed to do it because of the help of Illy Cafe. So it's a long story, but what I'm trying to say is that I guess one benefit of inserting yourself in international supply chains that you'll be, if you do that, for example, if you move from the commodity market to the same industry, but a high-end, differentiated segment of that particular industry, you might be able to escape the natural resource course, I guess.
Any of the other panelists want to join in? Please, let's just keep our remarks brief, because we're
very... very quickly on Mexico. I mean, if you look at Mexico's gross trade of flat-screen TV, it's the number one in the world on gross value added terms. In terms of gross value, right? In terms of value added, it's less than 6%, right? Of this. What does that mean? I mean, if you look, you think Mexico has the NAFTA agreement. They're in the Pacific Alliance. They have regional integration agreement with a lot of WTO members, except for one, maybe Israel. So does that tell you that it is actually the market access component, or is the domestic component domestic competitiveness that is lacking, and where you have to actually raise the level of of performance and efficiency, right? Look at what's happening now, the opportunities. If you're thinking about diversifying markets, you have the TTIP, the TTIP between the United States and the EU. Yeah, Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP is jet lag, sorry. So TTIP, right? So Therefore, you know, like within Mexico was a NAFTA, right? So products loses its origin once it enters the U.S. and then it can enter into the EU market. What's the challenge for Mexico? The challenge is to raise its game, its efficiency, so that it will, you know, be able to benefit from this and rather than, you know, be left out. Of course, Mexico, you know, may have teething problem at the beginning of this agreement, but that's you know, in terms of the global environment and region environment, everything is set for it to actually, you know, move forward. The problem is again is competitiveness at the domestic level, and if you look at the service sector, this is where a lot of action needs to be taken, a lot of reforms need to be taken. Especially in the transport sector, distribution, the domestic distribution sector, where, you know, Shenzhen mentioned the critical importance of a good infrastructure, right, in terms of moving goods in and out, you know, quickly and what have you. So the responsibility first and foremost rests within Mexico to raise its game.
30 seconds.
Kevin Ching's question on global value chain and exchange rate. I don't know. Have you come across my paper with Zhu Wang and Nikhil Patel? It's an NBR work paper last year. It's called Global Value Chains and Country Sector Level Exchange Rate. So it lays down a framework about how one can re-derive real effective exchange rate, taking into account both domestic outsourcing and international offshoring. So all the existing IMF, BIS, central banks calculation would be a special case of this. And it's also generalized beyond the two IMF work on this. Right, exactly. So we have a bunch of formulas that can allow you to do this. On export, what can exporters of natural resources do to in order to be better participating in global value chains? I will add the following remark to what my colleagues, co-panelists have said, which is that, you know, exactly for the reason you point out, normally when you are so abundant with natural resources, you find it's very hard to develop your manufacturing sector to be competitive. So Brazil has been complaining about this for a long time. Many countries in Central Asia that are exporters of natural gas and oil had faced the same problem. But they say, we want to diversify. How can we do that? Well, when commodity prices are high, exchange rate tends to be high, domestic manufacturing sectors tend to be not very competitive. The exact same logic would imply nowadays global commodity prices are so low, It may present a good opportunity if you use it well. I mean, it sounds like a bad thing to you if you are commodity exporters, but it could be turned to a good thing if you use the opportunity and pressure. Now that exchange rate lower, Kazakhstan is a leading oil exporter. Its exchange rate depreciated by something like 50%. And therefore, suddenly, the domestic manufacturing sector can be made more competitive if you choose to do that. So I want to add that note to this question.
Great, thanks. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. I think this conversation could continue. Clearly, this is a very interesting, important topic, and it's only going to get more so over time. I just want to thank the panelists for their presentation. Thank everyone for coming along. When you exit today, could you please just make sure that you use the back door only?